morning to everyone. We'll just be starting today's class in a few moments. We'll be discussing the beginning of Talmud Avodah Zarah regarding the end of times and some events that will take place. Mostly on the ideas, more than the actual historical account. And we'll take it step by step, and we will start just about a moment. The cover article on the Jewish Times for this week. So if you'd like to have it in written form, you can get it from the Jewish Times link on the left-hand side of the screen. Audio okay at the bottom of your screen to confirm that you're picking up the feed. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good to hear. And Cal, you there today, Cal?
I'm here.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
Good. So, did Daniel like the answer, Doug?
I apologize, I haven't gotten to him yet with them.
No problem.
But they are great answers, and I had it on my list to snag him and say, hey, we got answers to these.
Yeah.
But thank you for responding that, I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure, my pleasure. It's an important thing that, because people often have the idea that the Torah is archaic, it's outdated, and all these different idolatrous rites that people practiced back then that the Torah came to, you know, veer us away from. You know, it's outdated, so, you know, since those idolatrous practices are outdated, so we don't have to keep the Torah anymore. There's always that, you know, drive to break off the yoke of God's commandments. A person wants that freedom in life to do what they want. Same people, though, will not decide to have all that freedom if a doctor told them that they're going to die unless they take, you know, X number of pills every day for the rest of their life. Then they'll be meticulously, careful about making sure they take those pills, because the sense of their body is outweighs the importance that they should be giving to their soul. So, but, you know, like we said, the fact is that we're not, you know, the Torah is not coming to veer you away from specific practices, but the underlying psychological trends that are never going to change. You know, even after the Messiah comes, even if the Mashiach, it's still going to be the Torah. That means that the Torah that warns you against stealing must be applicable even after that. That means that people have the tendency to steal and all other things. So on that note, I guess we'll start with the subject matter for today. So I actually put it; it's in the Jewish Times this week too. So if you want to get around to it during the week, you can take a look. Also, we'll just go over the points. This way, it'll be more interactive. So if there's any questions, we can, you know, address them now. But the Talmud in Avodah Zarah, which is, again, this was Jack Saunders' question, a good question, because it actually gets his question is regarding something on the next page, which we'll get to pretty quickly. It seems to be that the Noahides were released from following the commands. But right on the page, right after it says that statement, it qualifies what that means. It doesn't mean they were released from the commands, it means they were released from receiving reward. Okay. And hi to Joshua and to JHS, and I guess that's I'm not sure what the suffix is, but good morning to both of you guys online. And let's start. So the Gemara starts, the Talmud starts on towards the bottom of 2a in idolatry in the Gemara Talmud Avodah Zarah. And it says that in the end of days, God will bring the Torah in his bosom and he'll place it in his bosom. He'll bring the Sefer Torah, he'll place it in his, like, his chest, and he'll say, whoever involved themselves in it, let him come and take his reward. So suddenly, at that moment, all the Ovdei Chacham, the idolaters, will come in a big confusion. And it quotes a verse from Isaiah, which is in chapter 43. It says, all the nations will gather together. So God says to them, don't gather in such confusion. You'll come one by one. Okay. So there's a long discussion as to how they're trying to validate. You know, each one of the nations wants to now jump on the reward, because God just said, and again, this is the end of the day, this is the Messianic era. And God comes out again, just holding the Torah scroll, and says, whoever has engaged in it, come and take your reward. So right off the bat, you don't need to be carrying the Torah in order to announce whoever wants the reward. Come and take it. Just say whoever's involved in the Torah. You don't have to have the Torah in front of you to refer to the Torah. So the question is, number one, why is that there? And again, every part of the story is really part of a metaphor that was arranged. It was authored by Rabbi Chanina. So it says at the beginning that Rabbi Chanina had made this drash. A drash is where he's not talking about something, it's a metaphor. So he's talking about a conversation between God and the nations. So we'll have to understand, what does it mean if it's really not literal, there really is no conversation, so what is the underlying concepts? What are the underlying concepts? And the sound is okay, Doug? How's it on your end? Okay. Okay, so they all come before God, they all want to jump on the reward. And basically, the different nations claim that, yes, what we're involved in, we built bridges, and we created marketplaces and bathhouses, and we amassed money, and we won wars, and all this we did so the Jews can have the conveniences that these things afford, so they can ultimately be involved in greater Torah study. And God responds back to them and says, no, you did this all for yourself. So another question we have is, how can they assume to pull the wool over God's eyes? That seems to be unfathomable. But yet, that's what the Talmud says they did. And God has to tell them, nope, you did this all for yourself. So ultimately, they all go out, all the nations leave God, shamefaced, but then they don't give up. And they say, well, did you ever offer us a Torah? So God says yes, and verses are quoted where it said that God came from the south and from different from Mount Seir, from different places that were the, which are associated with those nations. So they realize, well, they failed at that. They try a second question. They say, well, did you ever give us a Torah and that we rejected it? Right? Did we ever accept the Torah that we ultimately rejected? I mean, they're trying to defend themselves. Because ultimately, the whole question you got to keep in mind is God's offering the reward at the end of times and says, whoever was involved in Torah, let him come and take reward. So they are feverishly trying to suggest how they were involved. After they can't suggest this, and then they say, well, did you ever offer it to us? So now they're saying, right, we didn't do it, but when did we ever have an opportunity to do it? So God says, yes. It was offered to you. So they say, no, that's not what we meant. We meant that when did we ever accept it and then reject it, that we are to be to blame? So then God says to them, well, why didn't you accept it? So they realize again that God got them. So now they have to say, well, when did you ever force us to accept it like the Jews? Right? And that we didn't receive it. Meaning to say, when was there? I mean, the reason why Jews have it and all is, well, they were forced. I mean, if we had that opportunity, we would have it too, and we would have been involved. So don't blame us for not doing it, because we never had that same level of pressure of coercion. So then God says, no, you did. Originally, Noah kept the seven commands that I gave to you, but then all of you had ultimately abandoned it. And this is now what Jack Saunders' question was. It says after that, and this is the very last line on 2b, it says that since they didn't accept, they didn't continue to uphold their seven laws, so it was made permissible to them. So they got rewarded. The Gemara, the Talmud says, what? They got rewarded? Now you're going to find the case where somebody sins, where all these nations sinned, and they get rewarded for sinning because now they're let off the hook from even having to follow them. So what does it mean? That it quotes a verse. It quotes a verse in Isaiah 43 again. The God stood up and he measured the land and he saw and he permitted. So what the Gemara, you know, goes into explaining what that means. He saw, what did he say? He saw that the seven mitzvos, the seven commands that they accepted in the generation of Noah, ultimately were not upheld. And since God saw this, so that's what it means, that he saw and he let loose. He saw that they didn't fulfill them, and he let them loose from the commands. So Mar comes in on the spot, the son, he was the son of Ravina, and he says, no, it doesn't mean that God freed them from the commands. It means that even though a person, a Noahide, that would fulfill them now, so he does not receive the reward. That's what it means. He relinquished the reward. He didn't relinquish them from the obligation. But then Rav Meir steps in and says, what do you mean that they don't get reward? We learned that a Gentile that learns Torah is equivalent to a high priest. There's no difference. So how can you tell me that there's no reward if a Gentile... How can you tell me that the reward was released? So the Talmud concludes, no, it doesn't mean he doesn't receive reward at all. It means it's not as if. It's not akin. It's not equal to the high priest. He is the Gentile that learns now is like one who is not commanded and gets reward. And we know there's a principle that only those who are commanded and do an act of the Torah get a greater reward. But those who are not commanded and do it get lesser reward. On the spot, I'll just say Rabbi Chait once gave a nice answer why that is, that if you're commanded and you follow the Torah, you receive a greater reward than if you're not commanded and you do it. Meaning two people follow the same exact system, all right? But one's commanded and one is not. So the one, you would think the opposite. You would think the one who's not commanded is a greater person. Rabbi Chait explained that what it means is that when you are commanded and you do it, you are fighting against the rebelliousness that you have. Because once a person is commanded in something, there's a natural tendency to rebel against anything which is thrown upon him. So he has to go against that as well. Whereas a person that's not commanded has the freedom from that. He is not working on that part of his personality. So that's what it means that he's got a greater reward if he's commanded and he fulfills the Torah. I mean, greater reward means that he is in a higher level of perfection. He has done more in terms of working on himself. Okay, so far so good?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, and so again, we'll have to, if you want to just take notes just to make sure that we cover all the main points. So what does it mean that they were relinquished from their reward at this point because previous generations lapsed in their observance of the Noahide commands? So why is that? And there's also a Ritva and also I think it was Rashba that I saw, two Rishonim, two of the earliest rabbis after the Talmud's compilation, that both said that if, however, Noahide goes before a court and accepts the commands, then he's as if he is commanded, and now he receives the full reward. So it's not lost. All right, it's just talking about this the era right after Noah, that the people did not fulfill the seven Noahide commands anymore, and also all people after them. That even if they, like the Talmud says on the top of 3a, that it means to say that even if a Noahide, the Gentiles will fulfill their commands, they will not receive the full reward. So we have to understand why is that. And what specifically is the description? So the Talmud says that this person is as if he's not commanded and does the commands. So we have to understand what that means. Because the commands were never released. It was only the reward that was released. So why is this Noachide now as if he is not commanded? Okay? But if he goes before a court, then it's considered like he is commanded, and then he gets his full reward. Okay? And then also, what's this conversation between, you know, it really never took place yet, so it's a metaphor. So what is the metaphor about? And what is God doing in the beginning, coming with the Torah and saying, whoever involved himself, come and take a reward? Well, he doesn't need the Torah in his hands in order to do that. Okay. So now we're up to the point where it says now they don't have the full reward. So now the Gentiles, they say to God, well, and it's sort of like the attitude, well, if we can't have it, you know, the Jews can't have it either. So the next statement in the Talmud is, well, where do you see the Jews ever fulfill the Torah? So you see how the conversation progresses. So God says, I will testify that the Jews fulfilled it. They said, no, you can't testify. You're like a father to them. And how can a father testify against his own son? And they quote a verse that says that the Jews are the firstborn of God. Okay, so they have some knowledge of the Torah every now and then. So God says, fine, you don't want me to testify? I'll let the heavens and earth testify. So they say again, no. They are biased in the area because they were sworn to a treaty with you in another matter. Regarding, in the beginning, God said that I'm to create the heavens and earth for the sake of that the Jews should be learning Torah. And if they don't, then I'll turn the whole universe into emptiness and void as it was in the beginning. So they disqualify God's suggestion that the heavens and earth will testify that the Jews kept the Torah. So they say, no, we're not taking that. So God finally says, okay, I will take your own Gentiles and prove from them that they kept the Torah. And he says, I'll ask Nimrod, did Abraham bow down to the idol? And I'll ask Laban, did Jacob ever steal one animal that he was watching of his? And Nebuchadnezzar, did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, did they bow down to the statue in all these cases? And at that point, they accept that the Jews did keep the Torah, because now God proved it from their own people. They can't shoot themselves in the foot and say that we don't believe our own. So at that point, the nations finally say to God, let's start over again. So God says, no, what do you mean start over again? A person who prepares for Shabbos eats on Shabbos, meaning to say that you had your entire generations to be involved, and now when the reward, the time of the reward comes, you can't just get it without having worked for it. So only a person who prepares for Shabbos will eat. It's a metaphor. So you did not prepare for the Shabbos, so to speak, of the world's generation, which is the Messianic era. So how can you enjoy the reward? But the Talmud says, yet God does not come to his creatures and treat them viciously. He gives them one more opportunity. Okay? And keep in mind, this is all the metaphor. We have not gotten to the underlying idea yet. So we will have a little bit of a job. But there's a tremendous amount of clues here. So that's what it's good. When the rabbis talk a lot, it really gives you a lot to work with. So anyway, so God says, you know, I'm not going to be vicious with you. The Talmud actually says that God does not come viciously with his creatures. So he says, I'll give you one more mitzvah, and it's very easy, because there's no real cost involved, and it's called the mitzvah of sukkah. So the nations immediately, they're excited, they had the opportunity, God's giving them another chance. So they take the sukkah, they go to the top of their houses, the roofs, they build a sukkah, and they sit in it. And then God brings out the sun very, very hot. And it's just too hot for them. And they kick the sukkah and they leave it. So Thomas says, well, I mean, can you really blame them? I mean, the Jews also are exempt from being in the sukkah when it's too hot. Meaning if you're too uncomfortable in the sukkah, the law is that you don't have to sit in it. So the Talmud says, yes, but would the Jews kick it as they leave? No. Okay, so that covers the content that we'll go through. But there's a couple of segments. There's a beginning with God holding the Torah, and then the first conversation about the nations trying to say that, yes, we were involved. We built bridges, fought wars, amassed money, made marketplaces and bathhouses, all for the sake of the Jews so they can learn. God disqualifies them. And then they say, well, you're right. They accept that, and they keep on going to different arguments. The next series of arguments is a three-pronged argument where they first say, well, did you ever offer us a Torah, God? God says yes and reminds them. So they say, no, that's not what we meant. They revamp their argument. They say, did we ever accept it and not fulfill it? So God says, well, why didn't you accept it? So they realize they're wrong again. So they said, no, this is what we meant. Did you ever coerce us to keep it like you did with the Jews, and that we didn't, and that we rejected it? So then God says, yes, this did happen. You had the laws. I gave you commands, seven commands, and you ultimately rejected them. And that's where it says in the Talmud that because of that, they were released from it. And but Mar comes in and says, no, they weren't released from the obligation, they were released from the reward. Okay, that means that they still have to do it, they still have to keep the Noahide laws, but they do not get the same reward as before, because now they're akin to those who are not commanded and fulfilled. And those people who are not commanded and fulfilled are not on the same level as those who are commanded. So they weren't on the same level anymore as Noah. Okay? And then when they finally agree that, you know, they have no other argument than their own self-defense, and then they start attacking the Jews. They say, well, you know, the sentiment you can see clearly is that, well, if we can't have it, the Jews can't have it. So they say to God, where did the Jews ever fulfill the Torah that you gave them? So God says, I'll testify. They say, no, you're like a father. You can't. You're biased. So he says, okay, I'll let the heavens and earth testify, God says. They say again, no good. You made a treaty with them years ago, and they're biased also. So God says, fine, I will prove it from your own people. And he does, they accept it, and now desperately they say, let's start over again. So God says, first God says, no, you really can't. You didn't work for it, and you missed the opportunity. But ultimately God gives them a final chance, and he gives them sukkah. And they go in it, and then it gets too hot, and they can't take it, and they kick it, and they leave. Okay, let's take the first part. The first part is that God is now coming in the future, and he's saying, who was ever involved in the Torah study, come and take your reward. What are your observations on this?
Why would God ask them to come? I mean, he is the one who knows everything. So why wouldn't he just say, okay, you know, this group, this is your reward, this group, this is your reward. Why would he say to them, come and take your reward?
Right, well, I think the answer to that is that he's giving the opportunity for people to accept the judgment that they're going to receive. He allows them, it's called being matzdik the din, meaning justifying what they finally get. So the God allows a person the opportunity to speak up, and ultimately he wants to expose the flaw for the person so they recognize themselves. Because a person lives by a principle in his life where he always feels what he's doing is right. A person disguises that his entire life if he's living the wrong life. He justifies all the sins that he does before he does them. And the lifestyle he chooses, that's why people who are Jewish and not religious constantly are mocking the religious Jews. They have to keep on suppressing the reality that they should be doing this system too, but they're too lazy, they're too into their lusts to want to have any commands on their life. So they mock the Jew in order, that's the way that they justify what they're doing. The other nations as well, anti-Semitism, the same thing. There's a statement that says, why is Mount Sinai called Sinai? So the Hebrew equivalent of Sinai means hatred. So the rabbis say, because from Sinai came forth Sinah. Sinah is hatred. So Sinai is referring to the event which was undeniably true, that God chose this people and no one else. And this is something which other nations just can't stomach. So the anti-Semitism is a way to justify their own lives. So what God does here, he allows the opportunity for the nations to speak up and to finally accept the ultimate judgment. But you see that the fact is that God is carrying a Torah, and he says, who's been involved in this? Let him come and take his reward. What else can you say about that? I think there's two things we could say here. One is that in the end of days, the primary object that a person should have been involved in this Torah study is wisdom. So that's what the idea is that he says, whoever, he's not asking who was involved in this, who was involved in that. No, he says, who was involved in Torah? Meaning this is what the whole purpose of man is, to have intelligence and to be involved in wisdom. So that's the primary statement. But also the fact that he's only holding a Torah in his hand, so to speak. What does that mean? When he announces, come and take your reward, and the only thing he has in his hand is a Torah. So what does that teach? And Joshua, I guess it's Indiana, seems to have the answer ready, so I'm going to hold off and wait for you and the phone to think about that for a minute.
Well, is it a further emphasis of when it comes down to the last analysis, this is all there is Torah?
Exactly. Meaning he's coming with the Torah, that's the only thing in his hand, and he's saying whoever's been involved in it, come and take your reward. Meaning the reward is not something extraneous. The very involvement in Torah is what, you know, the greatest minds only wanted to be involved in, whether it was natural law, whether it was halachic law, Jewish law. Wisdom was the involvement of these greater minds like Einstein and Rav Moshe Feinstein and Maimonides and all the sages, the Talmud and Moses, not for any ulterior motive. There was no ulterior motive. So when God is saying, whoever is involved, come and take your reward, means that what they're coming to take is Torah. That is what's going to be involved. That is what is going to be the very reward. That's what the rabbis look forward to for the next world. They look forward to it because this would be a situation where it would be an unimpeded involvement in greater wisdom. So the one who learns for the sake, there's a statement, learning lishma, learning Torah. Lishma is learning Torah for the sake of the Torah itself and not for any other motive, because you really find enjoyment in the whole question and answer process. You uncovering new ideas is very exciting. It's a very fulfilling and satisfying thing. There's nothing more satisfying to a person. When people chase after physical enjoyments, it's all limited by design. Because if it wasn't limited, people would never stop. They would never stop being engaged in intercourse or eating. But by the very God limited these things in terms of how much the human body can consume. So we should be redirected towards an area that we can be completely fulfilled. A person doesn't get tired, and there's no physical strain when a person is involved in something which is very interesting to his mind. He can go on for hours. This is really what the design of the person is to be for. I mean, the food and all these other things are to be peripheral. We are, biological and physiological. We have desires, we have lusts, and we're not supposed to cap them and eliminate them completely, but they're supposed to be managed in a certain proportion, a certain ratio. So God is saying here, come and take your reward. The only thing he has in his hand is the Torah itself. So that's the second. So the two ideas again are that the primary involvement that God asks humankind to validate, were you involved in study of Torah? That is the prime activity. They should have been involved in it. And the reason why he's only holding Torah is because that is going to be what the reward is that they now can enjoy it in a greater level. Okay. All right, that's clear, right?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. All right, so now the nations come and want to claim, yes, we were involved in it. We built bridges, we amassed wealth, marketplaces, bathhouses, we fought battles, we piled up tons of money, all for the Jew, all so he can be involved in Torah. So that's how they're trying to answer God. Okay, so what does that mean? Again, there's no conversation going on. This is a metaphor. So how do we understand that?
Well, it seems like they're trying to almost rewrite history and take credit for a motivation for doing things that wasn't real.
Right.
Sort of like, you know, I really ate those chocolate chip cookies because I thought they were health food.
Right. They're basically trying to say, at the end of time, when they realize, because what's going to happen is there will be a worldwide recognition that the Torah was given and nothing else was given by God. So the Jewish religion is the only divinely given religion. All other religions are false. And when the nations recognize this, so now they come in a very confused state. As I said in the beginning, why they come in a confused state? Because they have to switch gears very quick. It's not going to be like they were preparing. All of a sudden, when they realize this, now look, like Maimonides says, that all the nations will realize that fallacy was inherited, that they inherited fallacy from their parents. All these religions were all false. But they still have emotional, they've still been doing it their whole life, so the emotional attachment is still there, but intellectually they realize that it's false. So that's what it's a confusion. The confusion is that they have to suddenly switch gears. They want to somehow justify what they're doing. So like you're saying, they're saying that, well, everything we did now, and this is just something, a reflection. What this really means is that when the nations recognize this, they will reflect on their lives and seek to justify their total existence throughout time. There's no conversation going on. But they're thinking to themselves, well, maybe, you know, yeah, I did this all for the Jew. They're trying to say that the fact that these things can be used for the Jew right now, I mean, there has to be some sense to what they're saying. So, these bathhouses and the bridges and money and all these wars, all the land that we took over, the Jew can use it all now, and now that justifies us. But no, the ends do not justify the means. That's what the message is here. The ends do not justify the means. And euphemistically, when God responds to them, quote-unquote, responds, so it means to say that reality, you know, hits them over the head. They try it, but they see it doesn't wash. They just can't tolerate that themselves. Okay, so that's the first series of the dialogue, the first series of interactions with God. So God here means that the reality, absolute reality, because that's what God is. So they will see that. The first thing, of course, they will try to do is to justify what they did. Once they see they cannot justify, so the next approach is they say, well, when did you ever give us the Torah? So they're going to reflect and see, is there some way we can get off the hook, because maybe it wasn't something that was really given to us. But they'll realize historically that yes, it did happen, that it was given. There was a statement, I think Rav Nachman says it, that God went to all the nations and offered them the Torah, but they all rejected it for different reasons. Okay. Let me just see if this, I'm sure that's Rav Nachman. No, that was Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the one who said that. It's you learn from the verse in Deuteronomy 33. God from the south, he came. What was he doing in the south? And what was he doing in Seir, which is the place of Esav, Jacob's brother? So the teachers had gone, went around to all the nations and all languages, and they to give them the Torah, but they did not accept it. Until he came to Israel, and they accepted it. So the nations now realize, okay, yes, you did give it to us, but did we ever accept it and then reject it? Meaning, all right, you're right, you offered it to us, but can you blame us? We didn't, you know, we didn't violate it. You know, again, a feeble attempt. So God says, why didn't you accept it then? Oh, so they say, no, I mean, they revamp their question again, and they say, well, when did you ever force us? Okay, but you see one thing through all of this, is how are they relating to God? That they keep on trying to lie, correct?
It seems like they're reacting as seeing God as an adversarial force in a courtroom, and they need to win.
Well, they agree with his position. They're just trying to say, yes, we did. We did do what you wanted. I would say adversarial, but they definitely want to win. They don't want to lose out on the reward. They finally see that this is the whole thing. They really messed up in terms of what they valued and what they, you know, practiced in their lives. And now they're just, you know, they're running like a chicken without a head, trying to desperately see if they can, you know, grab a bit of that brass ring. But what you see they're doing is they're not relating to God as absolutely knowledgeable of everything. If they would, there'd be no way you could lie. If you were on a trip with somebody and you both experienced everything on the trip, you couldn't tell your friend that you were on the trip with that we went some other place. You know, it's ridiculous. He was with you. He knows everything. So how could these nations now try to, you know, fudge what has been going on throughout all the centuries? But what this teaches you is that the whole concept that they had of God was completely infantile and completely humanistic. Yeah, we could twist words, we can lie, and you know, we can succeed that way. They don't look at God as being any as having ultimate knowledge. I mean, the whole view of God is wrong, but this it follows why they have to have this view of God, because they're following religions that are man-made. And the idea of God that the other religions have is false. So they don't, you know, they can't, you know, stop on a dime. As soon as reality hits them, and the only religion is Judaism now, but they've been conditioned. Their emotions are going in a certain direction, that full force. You can't just slow them down immediately and turn them around, and now they're all immediately perfected. That's not how perfection works. That's not how true ideas come to a person. So you see that although they may see intellectually that there's a truth right now that we have to accept, that all the religions are false but ours, nonetheless, the way they operate and how they view God is still completely corrupt. And it has to be that way. And that's why they're making all these attempts where they can twist things and all. Because they're not viewing God accurately. Okay, so that's an important point to see. All right, so now we'll get to Jack Saunders' question. What does it mean that finally, so God says, why didn't you accept it? So they said, well, you didn't, you know, force us to do it like you did with the Jews. So what do you mean, God says? He says, you were given the seven laws, Noah and his family kept it. Ultimately, you abandoned these laws. So you are to blame. And that's where the statement comes in that God stood up again. This is Isaiah 43. I think it's 43:6, if I'm not mistaken. And it says that God stood up. He measured out the land. He saw. The Gemara says, what did he see? He saw that they abandoned the seven mitzvahs. All right. So then the next word in that verse is v'yater, that he released them or he scattered. So that word also means to be permitted. So it seems like, you know, what do you mean? They're permitted? This is what you do? The Talmud goes on and says, a people sin and then they get rewarded by not having to keep the obligations anymore? What type of system is this? So Mar The son of Ravina says, no, that is not what it means. It doosn't mean they were released from the obligation of the Noahide laws. It means they were released from receiving the reward. Okay, and that's when Rav Meir comes in. This is 1 minute. You can't say that they don't get reward. We have another statement that says that the Noahide, that who studies the Torah is equivalent to a high priest. No difference. So Mar says, yeah, what I mean is that his reward is not as full as if he was still commanded. Meaning he is obligated to keep it, but his reward is not going to be given to him like somebody commanded. Okay, so that's what we have to understand now. What does this mean? That because there was a lapse in the observance of the 7 Noahide laws, that now all the Noahides afterwards, even if they kept it, the Talmud says, even if they kept the 7 Noahide laws, their reward is greatly reduced, and they are on par with someone who's not commanded. Even though they are commanded, but the reward that they will get is as if not commanded. This is the question we have to answer now. Why is it that the lapse now removes, to a great degree, the reward of the Noahide? And again, I would say philosophically as well that, you know, the rabbis do say, the Ritva and the Rashba say that if a Noahide goes in front of a Jewish court and accepts the Noahide law, so then he has the full reward. He has full reward on it. Now, I mean, philosophically, if a person who's Noahide recognizes the laws as coming from God, it seems to be the same, that the full reward is there, because the point is that the person recognizes that they come from God and is doing them because it's God's will. And of course, we have to, you know, just elaborate a bit. Why is it that when I know it's God's will, it's better than if I do the command anyway and I don't know it's God's will? Because the whole purpose of the commands is to come closer to God, to be more attached to the Creator. Right? Like the Shema says, that you should love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your might. And how do you do it? The next sentence in the Torah says that these words should be on your heart, meaning by learning and fulfilling the mitzvahs. So this is now how a person reaches that. So that really has to be the focus of a person in life, is to come closer to the Creator. Rabbi Chait once said, I remember at the end of a class, that he said, like parenthetically, that this should, you know, a person should know that he has to, at the end of, you know, a class or whatever it is, if it's something on the Chumash or something on the Talmud, ultimately he should now look at those ideas, and now it should give him a greater attachment to the Creator. It shouldn't be like abstract. You know, he's working on his ideas, and now he sees these nuances and all, but that now has to bring him to a greater appreciation for God, who is the source of all the wisdom. That if a person is just like working in a vacuum, and he sees great wisdom in the world, but has no idea there's a God, so he's missing the entire point. He wasted his life because he is not appreciating the source, that there's a source of wisdom. He's just like, you know, it's mental gymnastics. Okay. So that's why if a Noahide would then accept the command as being from God, now you're doing them because it's an attempt to come closer to an understanding of God. That is the highest level. That's the level of being like on the same level as high priest. But let's go back to our question. Our question is, why was the lapse of the generation, the generations after Noah, to keep those 7 commands, why did that now release the reward? That's the question.
Am I?
Yes.
So if they lapsed and civilization was not destroyed, then The keeping of the seven Noahide laws seems like it moved into the realm of being a voluntary as opposed to mandatory action.
Okay.
And would that therefore mean, if we go back to the statement we made earlier, that one who is required to keep a commandment gets a greater reward than one who voluntarily keeps it? If the seven Noahide laws moved into a sort of voluntary mode, then that would greatly negate the reward that one would receive.
Okay, why? When you say voluntary, are you equating that with meaning that they're not doing it because of God, that they don't know about God, or they do know about God?
Well, they certainly don't have the right concept about God. So...
Yeah, why is that? Why don't they have the right concept about God?
Because they haven't been learning.
So then it's the fact that they weren't learning that they should lose reward, not because they were not keeping it because God commanded it. You're giving a different answer. I mean, the Talmud is saying that they are not going to get the reward in the full form anymore because there was a lapse. And even in terms of the lapse in the observance. And even if they did fulfill it, they will not get reward as if commanded.
Oh, okay. I mean, the nations, to a degree, have kept the seven Noahide laws, but not because God commanded them, but because it probably made sense to them in order to have an orderly society.
Okay, good. Good. That's the key point. That they did not do it any longer because it was a transmission of the commands. Meaning, that's what lapse does, exactly. The lapse... Since they didn't do it, that's exactly what Thomas says, since they did not fulfill it at a certain point, so therefore the reward had to be mitigated greatly, because now the succeeding generations are not doing it because their parents told them God said you must do this. So it's not doing, they're not fulfilling the laws out of a attachment to the Creator. So therefore it's perfect why they can't get the reward, because they're missing the whole essence of what a command is. They're not doing it for the sake of the command. They're doing it, like you just said, merely to have a harmonious society. It's just pragmatism. It's for just pure practical reasons of doing it. Right? That's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay, that's exactly the point. So it's clear that the Talmud never said that the Noahides don't have the obligation anymore. It means that since there was a lapse in the observance, so now everybody else is going to fulfill it, will not be doing it because they're doing it out of a sense of a command, because that whole transmission that God said you have to do it has been lost. However, Noahide knows he's doing it because of the God's command, or if it goes in front of, certainly, if it goes in front of a court. So now what does it mean he goes in front of a court and he accepts it through God? Here's a beautiful idea. It means that if the Noahide now goes to the Jew, and now the Jew, who's the Jew? The Jew is the one who has the chain of transmission from God unbroken. Here's the key. Now that he goes to the Jew, and he accepts that these laws exist, so he reunites with that chain of transmission, not through his lineage as a Gentile, but through the lineage of the Jew. So through going to the Jew, who now has an unbroken chain, that these things are commanded all the way back to Sinai, and before, because we have the Torah from Adam, now you can say clearly that this Noahide is doing these commands because of God. So he didn't have to get it from his parents, now he can get it from the Jew, and he reunites. You see how that works?
Yes, thank you.
Right. Okay, so Joshua in Indiana is asking a question. If a Noahide today keeps the laws because God commanded them, is it enough, or should they seek to stand before a court? Well, it seems according to Maimonides, going before a court is the way to be sure that the reward you're receiving is complete. All right? I mean, that's clear.
Rabbi, is there such a thing today?
The question is whether there has to be any Beit Din in Jerusalem or a regular Beit Din. I know that Jack told me that he actually did this like a year ago. So I'm sure he looked into it, and he was, you know, he's careful about what he's doing. So I would say, yeah. I mean, you have the court system today. You have, you know, going to Beis Din as the right practice. And I know that Ray Peterson is starting to have that organize the conference next year. That is an element. Initially, when he told me about it, it sounded like just a, you know, ceremonial thing. But then subsequently, and I just sent him an email this week, that I came across it, the fact that going before Beis Din is a recognized institution in terms of accepting the commands. And then, you know, it seems to me that's a great thing to do. So maybe that'll be part of what he does at the weekend. I would definitely, something like this, speak to Rabbi Chait. I mean, this is an area of psak. You need a, you know, real brilliant mind who has a grasp of, you know, all these areas to give a ruling on it. So that would definitely be something to inquire about. I mean, philosophically, it seems to me that we're doing that, you know, that all of us equally accept God's system. So I say, definitely on a philosophic level, that we are doing it properly now. You know, Ben Noach and Ben Israel, because we recognize the truth of the history, and, you know, we've had contact with the great teachers that, you know, taught us, you know, the real fundamentals of Judaism. So on that level, going before a Beis Din is going to be more of a practical issue. But, you know, definitely there is the aspect of following what the law would say. So we definitely should look into it. Okay. All right. So this answers Jack's question. That there was never a release from the commands. It was just that since there was a lapse in observance because it was God's commands, and generations just kept it for practical reasons, and therefore, of course, they can't have full reward because they're not fulfilling these commands because they're trying to reach God. God's not in the picture. Though God is in the picture, of course, and the person is philosophically perfected. Okay. And I mean, I also was lucky enough to have seen another Gemara that, you know, relates to this, and it talks about that when the Torah was given again at Sinai, so those matters that were restated about the Noahide laws. So God didn't start the Torah from the event at Sinai and move forward. At Sinai, the Torah started from Genesis, from Adam, to give the entire history. So the Gemara concludes there that because God had reiterated again those commands that he gave to Adam and to Noah, and now he's giving them to the Jews, now those Noahide commands now apply both to Noahide and to the Jew. And whatever was not repeated over, and there was only one of the Noahide commands that was not repeated over, meaning when God told Jacob that they shouldn't eat from the the third rib in the back, the filet mignon, that part of the animal. So that is now something which only the Jew has. So that's the only thing which transferred and is no longer with Noahide. But all the others are. But the fact that Gemara is saying that the commands are intact shows you clearly that there was never a release. That's why I'm just bringing it up. Right. So that Gemara, which was written, you know, thousands of years after the, I'm not sure how many years exactly, but, you know, after Isaiah, the statement that says that the Gentiles were released. So if later on the Gemara states that the commands for Noahide are still in place, you see clearly that the rabbis of the Gemara never viewed this piece of Gemara here in Avodah Zarah as meaning that there was any real release of the commands. So that was really the important, the real question that Jack had. But even without that Gemara in Sanhedrin, I believe it's like 59b, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere around there. But even without that, our Gemara states clearly here, Mar, the son of Ravina, steps in and says, no, it doesn't mean that they were released. from the command, it means they're released from gaining their reward. Okay? Okay, so far so good. Any, let me just pause here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Good here.
Okay. So now, the last part that comes in is where the Gentiles recognize that they just messed up. They did not keep it. And now they say, well, if we can't have it, they can't have it. And they say to God, well, where do the Jews keep the Torah? So God says, I'll testify. They don't like that. So God says, I'll let the heavens and earth testify. They don't like that either. Yep. Also, you're biased. You made a treaty with them. So God says, fine, I'll prove it to you from your own people will testify. Nimrod and Lavan and Nebuchadnezzar, all your Gentile people will testify the Jews never broke it. They kept the commands. But what does this mean? Again, since this is not a real conversation going on, what does it mean that God says first, I will testify? They said, no, you're biased. Then God says, then I'll bring heaven and earth and they will testify. And they say, no, they're part of a treaty with you also. And God finally says, let your own people testify. And that they accept. So again, this is not a literal conversation. And what I would suggest is that, what does it mean God says will testify? Then he says heaven and earth, and then he says the nations. And God knows everything, so why doesn't he just tell them the final answer first? Why doesn't he just bring the other nations to testify? So I think an analogy would clear this up. If you have, let's say, a drug dealer, and he's in an interrogation cell with the DA, and they're trying to cut a deal. He's got like $5 million in drug money that they want back, and he's not willing to give it up. So they try to say, "Listen, you're gonna go to prison for 20 years and this and that, and we'll cut it down to 15 years if you cough up all the money." And he says, "No, forget 15 years. I'm not going to prison at all." So then the DA says, "How about 10?" And again, he goes back. And he says, no, it's all right, how about this? I'll let one of your own inmates decide what the deal should be. So then the guy says, fine. Because he figures his inmates are going to have the same perspective as him. But you see, the first thing that the DA is doing is trying to get this guy off the street. Because the best thing for society is that there are no drugs circulating. You know, more people would be hurt by ingesting these toxins. So, but on the other side, the drug dealer is trying to get the best thing that he wants. See, he doesn't care about the objective truth. See, that's what's going on over here. In the metaphor, God is presenting the best answer first. He has absolute knowledge, so he says, "I will testify that the Jews kept the Torah." Because keep in mind, the whole argument over here is that the Gentiles feel bad that they could not keep it, so they don't want the Jews to have the good either. So they say, where do the Jews keep it? So God says, I'll testify. Meaning, I'll give you the actual answer. I know everything. I will testify. What could you have greater than God telling you something? Then they don't like that, so he says, I'll let heaven and earth. See, what this conversation really means is that, again, the conversation didn't take place. But what it means is it's all going on in the minds of the nations in the future. They will see Torah is true. How that's going to happen, we don't know, but that will be a reality that will permeate the world, and there'll be a number of conflicts that they go through in their mind, because free will still exists, and also all of their allegiances to their own systems still exist, even though they know it's not true, but emotionally, it's still been pulling at them. So what does it mean that God, so to speak, is going to prove that the Jews keep the Torah? What that means is God represents providence. The nations will review history and see, even though they don't want to admit that the Jews kept the Torah and the Jews shouldn't really get the reward, but they're going to have to admit it when they think about all the miracles that God did for the Jew, meaning providence, as if God was saying, I will testify. But then they're going to reject that. They'll review history. They'll see that, yeah, you're right, God was involved with the Jews, but That's because they were his chosen. Again, they're throwing a humanistic type of a motive onto God. He has chosen people, but in the wrong way they look at it. So they say that's the only reason why, you know, there was miracles and stuff. Not because they kept the Torah. He just loves them more, that's all. So then they go into think, well, one minute. Not only was there miracles, but the Jews just were always successful. They were always spared. They were, even without miracles, we see that they went from nation to nation, and they stayed together, and all the other, you know, empires have crumbled and have evaporated, and the Jew is still here. So that's something where the Gentiles are now thinking from a natural type, meaning as if heaven and earth. Heaven and earth means natural law. So when they look at the natural events, that also seems to imply that the Jew was protected somehow. The Jew is doing the right thing. He kept the Torah. But they'll dismiss that too. That they'll also dismiss because God made the heaven and earth. Right? So since God favors, you know, the Jew, he made heaven and earth, so they're biased also, so to speak. As if God, you know, said to them that the heaven and the earth will testify. It doesn't mean that literally. It means that the realization that the Gentiles will have about the natural order surrounding the Jews' lives throughout the generations, that as well will make them think, you know, the Jews must have been doing something right. They must have been keeping the Torah. But then they'll dismiss that also because that's too closely tied with God. God made the heavens and earth. So they won't look at that. Again, they'll keep on trying to reject the reality that the Jew kept the Torah because this way it makes them feel good. Misery loves company. We can't have it, they can't have it. But then they finally think about the fact, one minute, what about all those cases where Nimrod and couldn't get Abraham to worship, and Laban, he was working so dishonestly with Jacob, and Jacob never once retaliated with any crooked act. He didn't steal one animal. And Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, who were thrown into a fiery furnace at the threat of bowing down to the idol, they did not bow down. And Nebuchadnezzar, they know historically that Nebuchadnezzar couldn't get them to bow down. Then they finally realize that they don't have an argument against the Jew. So it's really not a conversation with God. It's a realization as they look through history and they see the different elements. God's providence and natural law, and then how their own people themselves, they admit that the Jew kept it. Okay, so you see how that interpretation works?
Yes.
Okay, so that's how these type of, again, this is Rabbi Hanina who wrote this entire parable, this entire metaphor, and then it's up to us to derive from it what the truths are. But you see that the nations are still so, they're fighting tooth and nail here. They you see, the principle is here that you can't be perfected overnight. And so now that the desperate, they say to God, let's start over again. So God says, really, by rights, we shouldn't, because you didn't prepare for this era, so why should you enjoy? But God, again, does not want the bad for his people. He wants the good. So God doesn't come viciously, the Talmud says. He doesn't come viciously with his creatures. So he gives them one last opportunity. And he gives them a very inexpensive mitzvah. It doesn't really cost anything. Make a sukkah. Sit in it. What do you have to do? All you have to do is sit in the sukkah. Sleep in it. You're doing these actions anyway. So they jump at the opportunity, they make the sukkah, and then God brings out the sun, and it's very hot, and they just can't take the heat. And they kick the sukkah, and they leave. So what this means is, you tell me.
Well, is it an opportunity for God to say, look, I gave you the easiest, or, you know, what could be argued, one of the easiest mitzvahs to do, and you wouldn't even keep that? Well, how can you hold up this whole defense that says, well, you didn't give it to us, we didn't know about it, you know, blah, blah, blah?
Well, again, keep in mind, there is no real conversation going on. We're trying to get to the underlying message as to what is going to take place. So there will be no conversation over here. This is all something which is going on in the minds of the nations. So when it says that we have this one mitzvah and it's very easy and expensive, And so immediately they made the sukkah on top of their roofs, and then God took out the sun. All this is a metaphor. So it's not easy to extricate what the message is here, but I would say that since there's no dialogue going on, so what does this mean? It means that the nations at this point, when they realize that they have no arguments in defense of themselves, they have no arguments to accuse the Jew, the only thing left now is to try to do it. So they look for the most inexpensive thing, the easiest mitzvah, and they try to do it, which is sukkah. Right, that's what it means that God says, I have a mitzvah, and it's very light. What does it mean, it's very light? It means that God's not talking at all right now. This is going on in their minds. They're thinking, you know, we couldn't defend ourselves. We can't accuse the Jews, so let's try. You can't beat them, join them. So they try to do it in a very easy way. They're trying to get the easy way out and to get the reward, because that's, again, that's the entire story here. So they look for some easy way to become part of the system and to gain the reward. And then it gets very hot, and they can't take the heat, and they kick the sukkah and they leave. So, what does it mean? It means that the attempt that they had, you see right off the bat, that they want something easy, so they take a light mitzvah. And when it gets a little bit too hot and uncomfortable, so then they kick the sukkah. What does it mean they kick the sukkah? It means that they say this thing is no good. The object is no good. It gave us some pain, gave us some grief. We thought that we're going to have a nice, pleasant time if we keep the Torah. That's our opinion of what Torah life is. Everything is comfy. Everything is just pleasurable. That's what they're looking. Their whole view of what the Torah is still corrupt because they weren't keeping the Torah their whole lives. So they can't change all of a sudden. They never educated themselves in the Torah yet. So what is their opinion? Their opinion is, well, it's got to be pleasurable. It's all physically oriented. And if it doesn't give me the physical pleasure, then I don't want it. That's what it means that they kick the sukkah. See, a Jew can also leave the sukkah if it gets too hot. He doesn't have to stay in it. By law, he does not have to stay in there if it's uncomfortable. But he won't kick it. Why won't the Jew kick the sukkah? Because he realizes the sukkah is not really the essence of the system of Torah. It's the ideas of what sukkah teaches you that is the purpose of the mitzvah. The Jew understands that. But the Gentiles who have no training, when they see there's some pain with the sukkah, they take it out on the sukkah. They think all there is to the mitzvah is the physical part. Here, the whole mitzvah is just to sit in a physical structure. And if there's any pain with the structure, they'll kick the structure. They don't understand that behind every single command are tremendous ideas. And that's the goal of the commands. Of course, you have to act out the commands, but the whole purpose of the commands is to really unveil new ideas to the person. The biggest command in Torah is Torah study. Not all the other commands, not sukkah, not tefillah, not tzitzis. The greatest command is the study, because being involved in learning more about God, again, that's the whole focus of life. That's why, again, we have intelligence. If the Torah was just to do physical actions, all we'd need is a robotic mind and we could do all the actions. We would not need intelligence and deep thought and the ability to deduce and induce and all these different types of arguments. We wouldn't need all that if all the Torah was just to do physical actions. But that's the Gentiles' view. Since it's just a physical thing and this thing gave me pain, I'm kicking the object. Because that's all there is. All there is the object. They don't understand that there's something deeper. So when the Jew leaves the sukkah when it's very hot and he's allowed to, he doesn't kick the sukkah. He's uncomfortable. But there's no aggression towards it because he knows that there's something behind the command. And that's something he treasures. So there is no attack on the physical object because the physical object is not the whole objective of the command. You have to do it because it's a demonstration of your agreement with the principles. Yeah, and sometimes there will be discomfort. I mean, there's always going to be that opportunity. There's heat, there's cold, and you combine that with certain mitzvahs, there's going to be times where it's a little difficult. Yeah, I got to walk to shul today. There's 2 feet of snow, and can I make it? Am I going to slip? There's going to be some. It's cold outside. So, you know, but that's not always the case. Most of the time, it's very pleasant, and everything works out well. God doesn't put us on earth to have pain the majority of the time, but there will be, you know, if we're not careful driving, we could run into a tree. So, I mean, there is a neglect which causes problems. There's choosing to live in the wrong area can be problematic. You know, mudslides, if you live on a mountain, or if you live in a place where it's too far from a temple, so then, yeah, it's going to be a long walk, and then if it's hot outside, you'll be that much hotter when you finally get the temple. So, but for the most part, you know, the Torah says that her ways are pleasant. Okay. All right, so ultimately, hopefully, you know, the nations will take the opportunity to learn, but the initial response is going to be what this whole Talmud is depicting. The initial response and how there's going to be, you know, complaining and different types of arguments, and they're relating to God in a way where they don't have the right concept of God. That's why they keep on throwing up these futile arguments, these lies, and trying to fudge, you know, some validation for themselves that they did do something right. Ultimately, they'll see through it. Ultimately, they're going to realize that God is not going to allow them to, you know, pull the wool over their own eyes indefinitely. But, you know, we see that in the prophet also, that in the future, all sons of flesh will call out to God's name. We say that in the Olenu prayer, Kovodei Basar Yikra Shemecha. Right, all sons of flesh will call out God's name. But evidently, this Talmud seems to be indicating that it's not an overnight sensation. It's not something which will go without some, you know, fussing and fighting. And it makes sense, because a person can't change overnight. Once the realization hits him, then, you know, there's going to be, they want to grab for that brass ring, but, you know, they realize they didn't really earn it, and it's not a simple thing. So, that's really where I wanted to take up, where it concludes. But those, I think, are the main messages over here. And it's nice to see how an insight into how the rabbi is right, and to understand that when you read something now in the future, you go into it with even more appreciation of the depth of how they're writing and how they're delivering some concepts to us. And it's not just a simple read. There was a little back and forth on they have these Torah blogs. I'm sure you're familiar with them. So over the past couple of days, so one rabbi came out, and he fell short of really condemning 100%, you know, these red strings that the people wear on their wrists to ward off the so-called evil eye. And I felt he should have just come out straight and said these things are completely prohibited. It doesn't matter if it's your left hand or your right hand, if you wear it on your finger or on your wrist. It's the whole concept that you can do whatever you want, but if you wear a red string, now you are you have defense against anything evil in life. That whole concept goes against God's system of reward and punishment that's based on your internal perfection. So there's a whole back and forth, and it got to the topic about this thing called Shadim, or demons. I don't know if you ever heard about discussions on that. So it says in the Talmud, and again, I want to give you this example because it's a beautiful insight. And it really makes you appreciate how much knowledge the rabbis had and how not to look at their words simplistically. If they're sparing ink to write down something in the Talmud or anywhere, there has to be an important message they're giving him. So people have this concept of this thing called demons, whatever they want to think they are. The rabbis say, yes, if a person is like in the mountaintop or in the desert or in a cave or it's at night, he should not give greetings to a demon. So that statement alone, it really speaks volumes, because, you know, it seems to be on the surface that the rabbis are admitting to the existence of demons. It even says there's a Rashi commentary on the Parsha of Noah that says that Noah took two of everything into the ark, even demons. It's very interesting. Rashi says openly that Noah took two of a kind onto the ark, even demons. But what sense can we make out of this? And why is it, you know, the question you have to ask is, why is it that the rabbi said you don't give greetings only in four places? On mountaintops? In the desert? At nighttime? Or in a cave? So they're trying to hint to you what exactly this phenomenon of demons is. And what they're trying to say is that in these four cases, a person is isolated. And when a person's in isolation, I mean, we know that the worst punishment in prison is solitary confinement. The reasoning is because the greatest need that the person has is the psychological need to socialize. People need people. It's the worst pain to be lost. King David even wrote in Psalm, I think it's 107, where he talks about how people that were lost at sea, they were away from civilization. When they finally come back, they have to give praises to God because it's a very bad thing. So you see that throughout the Torah that this is recognized as being a very bad state to be in, and that...
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So what people will do is when they're in states of isolation, they will conjure up images of people because that's the need that they have to comfort themselves right now. When you're alone, you really want to be with other people. So what the mind does, it pulls a daydream on you, and it does it in places where you are isolated. That's why it's only these four places. Now we can understand what the rabbis meant when they say don't give greetings. They meant to say that this phenomenon will happen. If you're in isolation too long, you will want to be around people again, and you may think that something in the distance is a person. But they say, do not give greetings to it. That's all they say. They don't say the demon is going to bite your head off or kill you or do something wicked. They say one thing, don't give greetings. Why? Because since it's really a figment of your imagination, by saying hello to it, now it causes you to cross over from what is fantasy into reality. You're treating a fantasy as a reality, and that's what the rabbis didn't want you to do. This will happen, it's not going to happen to everybody, but the greater the person's social need is, and, you know, and that's emphasized by the fact that if a person's away for a long period of time alone, then that type of personality will almost certainly see things in the future, in the distance that look like a person in order to make him feel he's not alone. So I said, even if that happens, the rabbi said, don't give greetings, don't talk, because it's just a figment of your imagination, and recognize that. That's all. That's all there is to it. So you see another example of how when the rabbis speak, there's a lot to be derived. But they give clues in their words. So that's how we have to approach it, with understanding what are they trying to teach us. And you try to deduce things. Like with our Talmud that we just know, we know that this conversation is, he's saying this is something in the future, but since it starts off by saying that Rabbi Hanina gave a metaphor, so now we have to understand what the metaphor is. Okay, and there's many, many more, and we'll go through them, you know, with God willing. So, but for now, let's suffice. We like nice examples of how to understand the words. All right, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments.
None here. Thank you, Rabbi. That is a very interesting idea.
Okay, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of the movie Castaway, where when he was on that island, he created that somebody to talk to out of that, I think it was a volleyball. He called it Wilson because it was made by Wilson. And.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's exactly the thing. A person needs that more than anything. You need to be social. And Jeff, I guess, SD, is asking what does end of times refer to? We were just talking about the in the future, Jeff. This whole Talmud that we're doing is about the future. So that's what we're referring to as end of times. Okay. All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up here, and we'll pick up next week. All right, any other?
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure.
Take care and have a great week.
You too, everybody.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, so that will wrap up today's class. We'll put this online shortly, so if you missed any part of it, you'll be able to hear it in its entirety. It'll be listed under the new postings link and also on the audio page. And we hope you enjoyed it, and we'll pick up next week, same time, 11:15, New York time. Okay, but just if there's any changes in schedule, we'll post it on the Talk Live page. That's the first link on the top, on the left-hand side of your screen. And if there are any last-minute changes about classes or postponements or change of schedule, you'll see it there. So just make sure you take a look there a day or two before the class. All right, a good week to everybody.